You're tuned to Tidings from Hazel Khan. My guest today is Julian Treasure, speaking to us from London, where he is founder of the Sound Agency. Julian comes from what he calls a schizoid background, marketer and custom magazine publisher on the one hand, and on the other, a musician with a recording career, playing drums with many different bands.
So there were kind of two things going on. There was my job and there was my hobby. And when I sold my publishing company in 2001, I got the chance to bring these two halves together. So I'm one of the lucky people who gets to do what I really love, which is, you know, consuming the whole of me. And I started the Sound Agency in 2003. And it's grown, actually, in mission or in vision since it started. It was a little bit more prosaic when it started. I was looking at helping brands to use sound better. But the more I read, the more I, particularly when I wrote my book in 2007, I realized that actually the mission is to make the world sound beautiful. And there are two ways to do that, or two aspects to doing that. One is to help everybody I come into contact with to become conscious in their listening. And I do that with a lot of public speaking, including my TED Talks. I'm doing another one in July specifically about listening at TED Global in Edinburgh. And if they like it, that'll go onto the main website as well. So there'll be three there. But I speak on stages all over the place about sound, noise, listening, and so forth. And that's helping people to become conscious, because I think there's a big danger we're going very unconscious. The other part of it, though, is showing organizations that good sound is good business. And that's what the Sound Agency does. We work for big brands all over the world, retailers, banks, oil companies, telecommunications companies, all sorts of businesses, helping them to take control of their sound and to make effective and appropriate sound. And I mean, the good news is that good news is good business, that they make more money if they make better sound. And that's kind of a double win, because for those of us going around in our daily lives, we're subjected to all this noise, and a lot of it is made by organizations just thoughtlessly. They're not aware of it. It's an accident. It's the byproduct of other stuff they're doing. So if we can show them how to become conscious about the making of sound, then really we are moving towards that goal of having the world sound a lot more beautiful. In the old days, when the world was quite a bit more quiet than it is now, I mean, it's something of a myth to consider the world was beautiful and quiet in the old days. I mean, you had blacksmiths, you had people doing quite loud things. There were wars, there was church bells. There were a number of noise sources around, but nevertheless, we didn't have machines. And in that situation, we were surrounded by natural sounds, which we, over hundreds of thousands of years, became very used to: wind, water, and birds being the three primary ones. And by water, I mean, including in that, rain and running water. So those sounds, which are all stochastic, that is to say they're composed of lots of individual events randomly happening. If you think of the difference between a dripping tap, which drives you mad, and gentle rainfall outside your window, which is beautiful, one is not stochastic, the other one is. So there's something deeply calming to us about stochastic sound like that, and we grew up with it for a long time. And I think we listened to the world. It's a big way of connecting. If you think about it, listening places you in space because you're very aware of your surroundings, the size of the room, the people around you, and so forth, by little micro sounds that you're perceiving all the time. And listening also places us in time. In fact, I think it's probably true to say that our listening is the primary way we experience time. Sound always has time embedded in it.
Because it begins and ends, you mean? Or?
Well, as it continues, you know, you're listening to me speak at the moment, and the only way you understand me is by remembering what I just said. There's a flow there. There's always a flow. There's no such thing as a photograph of sound. It doesn't mean anything. An instant of sound is nothing. So sound always embeds in it the passage of time, and I think it's how it's the big way we perceive time passing. So we had that connection, and we were listening to each other. pretty much all the time. People were aware of people around them and so forth. And there was probably quite a lot more quiet reflection. There were certainly many more places where you could be quiet and not be disturbed than we have now. Those things are not so prevalent anymore. You know, the Industrial Revolution came along. We invented machines, so we then had mechanical noise. And then in the 20th century, we invented electromechanical devices. So we now have electrical and mechanical noise all around us, beeps you know, the noises of cars, of machinery, of transport. There's a hum, a backdrop of noise all the time. Now, in some places, that can be quite pleasing. If you stand on the 20th floor of a skyscraper in New York and open the window, it's stochastic. So it's not dissimilar in effect to rainfall or wind in leaves or something. It's the music of a city. But a lot of the individual sounds, if you're down at street level, bus brakes hissing suddenly behind you, or people dropping things, or clangs, or bashes, or cars backfiring, or whatever it may be. These sudden sounds are not healthy for us because they cause a physical reaction. It's one of the four big ways that sound affects us physiologically. And we're getting overdosed with cortisol, our fight-flight hormone, the whole time in cities.
You said that you wrote that how much the sound has actually, the sound level has increased. I think it was 80 decibels is pretty much the threshold at which people become, I guess, really seriously affected by this.
Well, 80 decibels is quite loud, and it's a typical street soundscape now. If you're at 83, 84 decibels, you're having to shout quite loud to be heard. And at 85 decibels, in Europe at least, it's obligatory for your employer to provide you with hearing protection if you're in that environment for extended periods. Most audiologists would say that extended exposure to 80 decibels plus is bad for your hearing.
So yes, also you said that with wind, water and birds, WWB as you hand it, that's a different kind of listening. It's more of an unconscious listening. But with noise, we're actually trying to suppress it all the time. So it's a very different physiological and psychological.
Yes, I mean, this is the issue, that we've become habituated to suppressing sound because much of the sound around us is accidental and unpleasant. And therefore, we've got into the habit of just squashing it, of ignoring it, and it becomes a reflex action to do that. So we become less and less conscious of the sound of our surroundings, less and less connected to it. Doesn't mean that the sound isn't affecting us. Even though we're not conscious of the bang and the shot of cortisol, that happens. Even though we're not conscious of, I mean, the second effect of sound is psychological. We may not be conscious of the fact our mood has changed because we've moved into a jagged, sharp soundscape full of unpleasant sounds. We may not connect the fact we're feeling antsy, irritable with that, but that's the effect it's having.
But at the same time, I think you also use the word loss and pining for what you also call the signature sounds, one of the signature sounds of a planet, that is the wind, water, and bird song. That we've lost those, and the loss seems to be irreplaceable.
Yes, well, that's a personal theory. There's no research that says that we're pining for wind, water, and birds, but it's a tenable theory, and I suspect it's behind the fact that most people will come into a quiet room and have to turn something on because they feel there's something missing. There was a backdrop that we evolved to over a very long period of time, and it's recently been removed. So we use all sorts of methods to produce some sort of a calming backdrop of sound. And it's an interesting question to ask why many people find silence so threatening. In silence, of course, we meet ourselves. And that's perhaps an experience that a lot of people don't enjoy very much. And also, we've become unused to it because it's so rare to experience silence in the modern world that it's an unusual, strange, new thing for many people. And, you know, a lot of people just don't like new things at all. But I always say when I'm talking in public about sound, I think it's a wonderful practice to seek out silence just for a few minutes a day and to sit in silence, because it kind of resets your ears. It's like a sorbet in a meal. It's silence is the soil from which all sound grows. And just as you can't enjoy a mountain unless you have a valley to look at it from, you can't really enjoy sound unless you've got the yardstick of silence to compare it to.
But we, as you say, it's silence is sort of the horror of the vacuum too, I guess, for people. You said you might see yourself in there. I think, yeah, basically you don't know what you're going to see in the silence. And
absolutely. So, But it's interesting that every spiritual practice that I know of on the planet incorporates silence in the form of meditation or just being still into it. You know, there aren't many which are continuously noisy. You know, even going back to shamanistic practices, there are chanting and dancing and communal noise-making activities and so forth, but there are also going into, you know, caves or holes and sitting in silence and possibly chanting with it, but, you know, sitting with it as well. So it's always been a factor. The contrast is what makes one conscious. So to understand noise and its effects, you need to understand and experience silence and its effects. Otherwise, your scale, your yardstick is extremely distorted.
Okay, so if we go from silence to music, you write somewhere that that humans are most fascinated by music, and you say it's because we can create it. We can't create... Can we create silence? I guess I don't know if we can create silence, but
No, you can't create silence. You can allow it, I think, if you're lucky enough. Well, we can't make light, that's for sure. We certainly can make sound, though. And what's interesting is the ubiquity of music. In every human culture, there is music, and that's always been true, as far as we know. You know, as far back as we have fossil instruments. So it seems that to be human is to be musical, and to be musical is to be human. Leaving aside birdsong, which is a slightly different form of music making or sound making, certainly we seem to be the only species on the planet that communicates, you know, in communities in this fashion. Of course, our relationship to music has changed again massively in recent years. Since recording was invented, you no longer have to go and see people. Well, in fact, if you go back before that, music was entirely communal. It was made by groups of people. And only much more recently have we created this distinction between the performer and the audience, so that there are, in inverted commas, musicians and, in inverted commas, non-musicians. And if you go to Africa and say you can't sing, people think you're crazy because everybody sings. So, but we create this distinction that means I have the right to be on a stage, other people don't, or I don't have the right to be up there and other people do, or whatever it is, which makes us into a passive consumer of music rather than enjoying the full relationship with it, which is to produce it and to consume it. The other thing about music is that it's extremely potent. It's very powerful as a sound. It affects us probably more than any other sound on the planet. It often has words embedded into it, so it has direct meaning. It definitely conveys emotion. And this is where I think intention is so important. Nobody quite understands how music works. There have been lots of books on it, quite a few recently, on the neurology of it or the psychology of it. And none of them have quite decoded the black box that is the way music communicates. But it does do that. We all know that. It changes the consumer of the music, the person listening, in lots of different ways. And it does that very fast. We recognize it extremely quickly. And it does it because of association. So we associate music with things It might be a memory from the past. Music can bring back memories very fast. Or it might be a person or an experience quite recently. If I played you the first two notes of the Jaws theme, you'd immediately be thinking about a shark. So it's very rapid. And that's why I think it's rather sad that music is being used now as some sort of a veneer to spread all over every possible environment that we move in, whether it be a restaurant, a hotel, a shop, a bus, a taxi, you name it, a train station. They were all getting music, which is being misapplied as a sort of wallpaper when it was made with the intention of being listened to. So there is a conflict of interest there. The music wants to be listened to and people are dumping it in the background. And you know, it's like caging a tiger. It doesn't work.
This is Tidings from Hazel Khan on WPKN 89.5 Bridgeport. Julian Treasure is talking to us from London about sound.
We are very excited about the possibilities at the Sound Agency for generative sound. That is to say, sound that you program rules into a computer, and the computer then generates the sound. It's always evolving, always changing. It's not music, but you could make it musical, or you can emulate a natural soundscape. And the important thing is it doesn't repeat itself. I mean, what the shop workers go nuts about is the repetition of, you know, listening to Jingle Bells 500 times in the months leading up to Christmas.
And so this generative music doesn't have repetition. Is that the same as stochastic, or is that nothing to do with it?
No, it's different. Stochastic is a collection of random events which create a sort of seamless whole. Generative just means that it's probabilistic and it's created live. So the computer's jazzing, if you like. It's riffing. There's nothing recorded, it may be playing samples, but the music or the soundscape is not recorded at all. It's not just playing you a recorded thing. It's actually making it up as it goes along. So there's a life to the thing. If you are clever at programming the probabilities, you can really emulate natural scenes extremely well.
The overall objective then of having your sound designed is one thing, obviously, to make your workers' lives better and to make them more productive and so on, I imagine, or shoppers or those things. But are there other applications? I mean, could government have commission you to do sound design for them, CIA or something?
Well, I don't think you can start to think about mind control with sound. Sound has been used as a weapon, and there's been research on doing that with both very high frequency and very low frequency sound. And there are sound grenades, there are, you know, hypersonic loudspeakers that project unbearable beams of sound. So, you know, sound can be abused just as much as my dream of making the world more beautiful is possible with sound. What we're talking about is pretty much on the level, I would say, Hazel, of painting walls white instead of garish multiple colors which clash. So I don't think we're into controlling. What we're looking to do in any environment is to create something that's just pleasing, doesn't get in the way, and supports people in whatever it is they want to do there. Now, the old-fashioned way of doing of music being played in workplaces, which is way back in the 30s and the 40s, I don't think this has been done for a long time because it's pretty crude, but they used to play songs with accelerating tempos from the top of the hour through to 50 minutes. So you get to a crescendo at 50 minutes and then give people 10 minutes off and then start again. And they found that affected productivity. Now, that's kind of manipulative, and I wouldn't get involved in something as crude as that. But, you know, we all know how to program music, for example, that's appropriate to what we're doing. And if we're going out for a big night out, we're not going to be playing slow, sad music. We'll be playing something with a beat that's accelerating our whole tempo and arousing us into a state of excitement. People understand that. And some jobs people do less well without sound. If you're working in a factory and it's an extremely boring job, then it's pleasant to have music on because you've got something else to focus on. And when it's been removed, people have got very upset in factories at having their alternative stimulation taken away. So that's one thing. Noise in offices is a big problem. And I'm certainly not suggesting we put more noise into offices. In fact, many offices need to have noise removed because workers who are subjected to other people's conversation and loud offices are roughly a third as productive as people in quiet rooms. So there's a big cost to that. On the other hand, if your office is deathly silent, then it's inhibiting because you don't want to pick up the phone and make a call because everybody can listen to you. So there's a happy medium. You know, it is all about, the word I use an awful lot is appropriateness. It's designing, intentionally designing a soundscape that's appropriate and effective, if possible, beautiful, if possible, branded, and which leaves people feeling a little bit nourished, relaxed, at least isn't debilitating them and irritating them and stressing them. And so many places that you and I have to enter at the moment do those things to us, even though we're not that conscious.
This is sort of like the more the benevolent end of sound and music. I was thinking of things you mentioned about the European community and the reports, noise mapping reports they've done. And I think in London, there's a report called Sound of City or something like that, a Sound of London. So, I mean, the effects, the negative effects of the inappropriate sounds are really quite serious.
Yeah, we can't go on in the way that we've been going. You know, the accelerating noise levels across the world are serious. And of course, as the rest of the world gets industrialized, I mean, look at what's happening in India and China at the moment. It isn't just fumes and pollution they're releasing into the air. In fact, the European Union has just it was the World Health Organization has just done another study in Europe, and their estimation now is that sound is having a more deleterious effect on health than airborne pollution in Europe. 25% of Europeans are living in places where the sound at night is way above the World Health Organization recommended maximum, and that is affecting their sleep. So the knock-on effect of sleep deprivation is all sorts of ill health, depression, stress, physical ailments of varying kinds, not to mention the social cost of irritable people, you know, bumping into each other and having arguments, and who knows how much of those are actually a result of noise in cities as opposed to other factors. So it's a really serious issue across the world. Another number that just came out about Europe from the WHO is that each year in Europe, 1 million years of healthy life are lost to noise. Long-term exposure to noise is increasing the risk of ischemic heart disease and death, and it's also increasing the risk of a variety of other things like strokes and, you know, just a range of serious health conditions.
And that's just the humans, you know. I mean, I always, whenever I see power boats on our bay and sound out here, Long Island Sound, it makes me crazy because I think, what is it doing to all the marine life when these machines go thundering across the surface of the water?
That's a really sad story, and it gets much, much, much worse when you get deep under the ocean, where you've got the US Navy in particular with active sonar, which sends cetaceans, whales, and dolphins anywhere within its radius, crazy. I mean, it's like the loudest sound they've ever heard. And the background noise of our shipping, which occupies a frequency range, which is pretty much deafening whales. I don't know if you know, but water conducts sound far better than air. And that's why whales have been able to communicate in very rapid time over hundreds of miles. You know, I can't call to you over 100 miles, but in water, whales can call to each other in quiet water. They can call to each other over hundreds of miles because water conducts, it moves sound faster and it conducts it better than air. And now we've got all these ships moving across the surface. The background hum of those vessels is sending the whales deaf. They can't hear each other anymore, which is extremely sad.
Thank you.
And there are plenty of interesting sounds in the universe, just as if you put a microphone under the water, the sea is absolutely alive with sound. I mean, fish are some of the noisiest things on this planet. We often think the sea is silent, but it certainly isn't. Just in the same way, if you start to transpose radio signals from things like black holes and pulsars, if you transpose those down into the audible range, they become very, very interesting sounds indeed. And there are recordings of those on the web, which anybody can access. Obviously, there is no sound in space because space is a vacuum, and sound, my definition of sound, is vibration that we can hear. So it's interesting to listen to those patterns and consider that you know, these things are going on and kind of sound that we can't hear way above our heads.
So maybe then, will we hear when the world ends with a bang, not a whimper?
or a whimper.
Well, yes. Will we hear it?
Who knows? Well, I hope I won't be around then. Yeah. And I do hope that by the time we get to that stage, we will be talking about a much, much more pleasant planet where we're actually designing our own environments with sound, our homes, our offices, our factories, our transport systems.
When you talk about these things, do you find that people have some difficulty? I mean, a lot of your concepts are relatively novel, at least to the sort of the average person. The whole idea of designing sound. I mean, you know, I could say, oh, I see what you mean, but I'm not sure I can say I hear what you mean. I'm just wondering if there are things you find that it's difficult for people to grasp.
So far, my experience is this is quite transformational, and that most of it's actually common sense. So the reaction I get most commonly from people is, well, do you know, I've never thought of that before, but now you mention it, it's obvious. Because most of it is, it's just that we've become so unconscious. So really, when I speak at conferences and so forth, I unfailingly get the reaction of people coming up and saying that was so amazing because I'd never thought of it before and now I'm listening to the world in a different way.
Then it's easy to understand. It's just you wouldn't have come to it by yourself. It's very good. But thank you very, very much, Julian.
My pleasure.
That was Julian Treasure, founder of the Sound Agency, speaking to us about sound from his home in London. You can learn more about Julian and his company at thesoundagency.com. Tidings from Hazel Khan can be heard on the second Wednesday of each month at 6:30 p.m. and is archived on tidingsfromhazel.org and on wpkn.org. Tidings is produced by Tony Ernst.